Is another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're listening live at Joy 620 on your drive home, or you're listening to the podcast at investinghope.com or Google Play or iTunes, wherever you get your podcast. You can find this one. We certainly appreciate that. You can learn more about what we're doing at Hope and investinghope.com. A lot of things to talk about today. We're going to look at Psalm 139, and the reason we're going to look at that is because it's Sanctity of Life Month, and I am spending every single Sunday in the month of January and one Sunday in the month of February at churches speaking about life and hope and the work that's being done, and we've already got a few under our belt. I'll be at a church this Saturday, Seventh-day Christian Assembly, and then Union Baptist on Sunday. And then I'm headed to Washington, D.C. next week to join 500,000 people for the March for Life. We'll be there. Enjoying ourselves there as we stand for life. Always look forward to that every year. Also long for the day we don't have to have a march, and that abortion would be a thing of the past, and that Roe v. Wade would be overturned. I feel like we're getting closer and closer to that day. Again, if you want to partner with us, to volunteer with us, to support us, you can at investinghope.com. Before I get into the topics today, I do want to say thank you. Thank you for making 2019 one of the best years ever at Hope Resource Center. And I say that for a number of reasons, not just because the patients that we serve, that's been amazing. We provided more baby showers than we provided in years. We had one of the largest classes we've ever had at the end of the year in 2019. We have between 19 and 23 patients meeting right now as I'm talking for parenting class at Hope. And so we're starting the year off great, but also we finished the year 2019 with a year-end campaign, and we do that. Most nonprofits do that, and we seek to raise money. We seek to finish the year out strong. We have a budget that is close to $900,000 to allow us to serve our patients well here in the Knoxville area. And our goal for year end was around $190,000. We wanted to finish the year out by bringing in $190,000. And I'm here to tell you that through your partnership, through your gifts, not only did we meet that goal, but we exceeded that goal by about $15,000. And so we brought in over $206,000 to finish the year out strong. And we are just so grateful for that. That year end campaign, The $206,000 is the best year-end campaign we have had since I've been at Hope for 5 years, and I'm pretty sure that's the best we've had in a very, very, very long time. And so that doesn't happen without your support. I was in Nashville last night at a reception with Susan B. Anthony List. They're doing some great work nationally and locally for the pro-life movement. And I was at the reception, and I went up to a state rep from East Tennessee, east of Knoxville, over in Johnson City, and was talking to him about our work. And he said, "How are you funded now?" And I said, "We're funded fully through individuals, businesses, those that just want to partner with us. No tax money, no state money, no federal money, no insurance money." And the look on his face was priceless as he said, "That's amazing." And so I don't take for granted that the reason and that we're able to do that is because of people like you that are listening to this show, that are stepping out, that are going to churches, hearing us speak, that are partnering with us, that are feeling a sense of conviction to stand up and get involved. And we are so grateful that you would partner with us in that work. And so as I'm going around this month, I'm focusing on Psalm 139. And if you're new to the show, if you're new to what we're doing at Hope, over the last few years, I've kind of taken a verse. I've looked in Scripture and prayed through it. Where do we need to focus for the Sanctity of Life message? We've talked about the woman at the well and how God stepped in, how Jesus stepped in, and we saw life celebrated, and how Jesus went to the woman at the well and said, "I know who you are. I know what you've been through. I'm not going to shame you. I'm going to bring you something that's going to quench your thirst, and that's the gospel truth. And she went out and spread the gospel from there. We last year we focused on Adam and Eve and in the garden, and that even in the messiness, even in the chaos, even in the brokenness, after sin entered this earth, after Eve took of the apple, after Adam stood there twiddling his thumbs and did nothing to protect his woman, what we find is God still entered the garden. And so even in the chaos, even in the brokenness, he could have said, we're going to start all over from scratch. Y'all messed it up. Instead, he walks into the garden. He looks at his people. And we see right there in Genesis 3, we see already we're foreshadowing what's happening at Calvary. As an animal has to be sacrificed to cover up Adam and Eve, to cover their sin. And we see there that this will take care of it for now. But this points to something greater, a mediator that's going to come in the form of a Savior, which is Jesus at Calvary. And so we that's what we've looked at the last few years. This year, what I wanted to do was look at Psalm 139, as I'm sure you're familiar with. Psalm 139, verse 13, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were framed, formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." And so Psalm 139 is kind of the verse of the pro-life movement, right? I mean, that's the verse we look to. Well, why are you pro-life as a gospel person? Well, what Scripture tells us right there in Psalms, that we were formed in our mother's womb. So that means the unborn are precious. That means the unborn have value. That means they should have value to us. If they have value to God, they should have value to us. And the amazing thing about this text, when you take this text, what that really means of you saw my unformed substance, you knitted me together in my mother's womb, what that looks like in conjunction with the science, right? So we have Psalm 139 written thousands of years ago. We have that where it says, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. And now in 2020, we look at what science says about the forming of a baby in the womb. And I love to look at both of those in context with each other. In month one, we have a primitive face will take form. Mouth and lower jaw and throat are developing. The tiny heart tube will beat 65 times a minute by the end of the fourth week. And the baby is a quarter of an inch long. Month two, we have tiny buds that will eventually be arms and legs that begin to form. Fingers, toes, and eyes are forming. The neural tube, the brain, spinal cord, and other neural tissue is well formed. Bone starts to replace cartilage. The baby is now an inch long, and a heartbeat is now detected. Month three, arms, hands, fingers, toes fully formed. Open and close its fists and mouth. Nails are developing. Reproductive organs developed. All organs and extremities are present. Circulatory and urinary systems working 4 inches long in month three. Month four, heartbeat now audible by Doppler. Eyelids, eyebrows, eyelashes, hair are formed. Teeth and bones become denser. The baby now sucks his thumb, yawns, and makes faces. Nervous system starting to function. The baby's now 6 inches long in month four. Month five, you feel movement. Shoulders, back, and temples are covered by stiff hair, or soft hair that protects the baby. And this hair sheds after the first week out of the womb. Shins are also covered in it with the protective hair, 10 inches long at this point. Month six, eyes are open, responds to sound. 12 inches long. Month 7, hearing fully developed, 14 inches long. Month 8, can distinguish language and accent. And we talked about that on the show before, that what that means is when my babies were growing inside of my wife, by the 8th month, they knew their mom and dad were Southerners. They knew the accent was going to be Southern. Now, they couldn't have told you it was Southern, but what they knew was they were going to recognize our voice once they got out of the womb. Lungs are still developing at that point in month 8, 18 inches long. Month 9, the baby is fully formed. So the question is, are we somehow more or less human at month one or month nine? Are we somehow more human at month nine, or in my case, at month 430? That's where I sit today, 430 months of life. Am I more or less human today than I was when I was growing inside of my mom? You see, the only difference is size and proximity. The same Andrew that was being formed in 1984 inside of my mom in Cornersville, Tennessee, is the same Andrew that speaks today behind this microphone. Just as human, the only difference is size and proximity. Looking at the development stages in conjunction with Psalm 139 shows us the love of God. We even see there in month five when we find out that the shoulders, the back, and the temples are covered by soft hair. They're covered why? To protect the baby. Why does a baby need protection in the womb if it's just a clump of cells? But see, even God in his authorship is protecting the baby in the womb. And the amazing thing is we have that safe place in the womb, and then a week after we're born, that hair is no longer needed and it sheds away. Its only purpose is to protect while in the womb. God values life in the womb, and so should we. You see, Jesus arrived as an unborn baby. The first person to recognize Jesus was an unborn baby, John the Baptist. God loves the unborn, and we should too. So if you want to hear more of that, then be at one of the churches over the next few weeks, and I'll go in a little bit more detail of that text and what that means for us. You see, I'm pro-life for a number of reasons. From a science standpoint, certainly. From a neighbor standpoint, certainly. But the origin of my pro-lifeness is the gospel. Even the psalmist saw that he was formed and knitted together in his mother's womb. The days were all laid out for him, even before he took his first breath. That's an amazing truth. So we don't have to get angry and bitter when we talk about why we're pro-life, why we're against abortion. We are pro-life simply because, for gospel people, because we believe that every single life is authored by our Creator. I had a man come up to me on Sunday at a church, at the church I was speaking at, and he said, 72 years ago, my mother was raped. 72 years ago, my mother was raped. And he said, I thank God she didn't have abortion as an option. And he said he was adopted. And he said he found his mother. And he said she thanks God that she didn't have that as an option. 72 years ago, a life was given. And that life still walks today. We'll talk more when we come back. So the conversation continues as it always does. And you know what? Even when I'm not on air, the conversation continues in my head as it always does. It just never goes away. But today what I want to do is the first segment we're talking about the work that's being done, I guess kind of Psalm 139 in conjunction with science as we see today and how science has simply proven Psalm 139. Now I want to shift focus a little bit to an article over at the National Review talking about big families. The New York Times had a piece discussing big families, with families that have four or more children. Well, guess what? The Wood family has four children at the moment. And so I thought it was an interesting take, and National Review kind of did a review of that article. I'm not going to read the New York Times article. You certainly can. But I thought the piece in National Review does a good summation, and then we can discuss from there. So the parenting section of the New York Times has just published an interesting article featuring parents who are raising families of more than four children. Something that was commonplace even a few decades ago now deserves commentary and analysis in the pages of the nation's most read newspaper. But the feature, written by Laura Vanderkam, a working mother of five under the age of 12, who welcomed her newest baby at the end of 2019, does a good job of exploring what it's like to raise several children at a time when fertility rates are continuing to drop and the average woman in the U.S. is now having fewer than two children over the course of her lifetime. Under these conditions, it makes sense that fewer and fewer people understand why couples would choose to have so many children that they need to purchase a car like the Ford Transit, which, as Vanderkam puts it, is more commonly employed as an airport shuttle. Now, this particular mom purchased a Ford Transit. I, on the other hand, have a Ford 2003 Ford Econoline E350 12-passenger van that probably can go a lot more places, a lot rougher places than the Transit, but I digress. Mine probably looks a little bit tougher and manlier with the stickers and the mud tires, but that's another story for another day. And that's all true. You'll see me driving around town and you'll go, hey, he's telling the truth. He has one of those vans. Perhaps surprisingly, a 2018 Gallup poll found that 41% of adults in the U.S. think that it's ideal to have at least three children, a figure that rose from 33% in 2011. But even so, the same poll found that half of Americans say it's best to have only one or two children. And 41% doesn't look much like when you consider that back in the 60s, nearly three quarters of respondents told Gallup that three or more children is ideal. I can attest firsthand, this is the author of this National Review piece, to the fact that large families are countercultural and as a result often misunderstood or derided. I grew up in a conservative Catholic community in the Washington, D.C. area, the same community that author and Washington Examiner writer Tim Carney talks about in Vanderkam's piece when he explains raising six children with his wife. Though from a small family myself, nearly all of my best childhood friends had more than three siblings, and some had as many as eight or nine. When our parents took us to an amusement park together, people assumed we were some kind of field trip or daycare center rather than three families spending a weekend together. And in the Wood family, similar. I have two brothers, so we were a family of three children. My mom is one of seven kids. My dad was just one of two kids, but my oldest brother has four children. My other brother has three from his first marriage, and then he has three, stepchildren that are just like his own. So he has six total, and then my wife and I have four children. So we are, bucking the trends that the folks are just having one or two kids. The Wood boys said, no, we're not going to have that. We're going to procreate and make sure that Wood name continues on for many generations to come. The article goes further. That isn't to say that the culture is always hostile to large families. For the most part, aside from the occasional snide column insisting that having children harms the environment, it's much more common that people simply don't understand the choice to have more than a couple of children, especially consider that raising children takes so much money and so much work. The Times piece shows skeptics how these parents make it work. And they quote, people who are raising two kids think this seems immensely hard, and so they imagine that six is three times harder than raising two, Carney told Vanderkam. But the marginal increase in difficulty is smaller with each one, and that is a true statement. After you have the second, the others just continue. There's a comedian that he makes this, and obviously this is tongue-in-cheek. He's a Catholic comedian, and he has five children, and he says people often ask him, what is it like to have five children? And he says, just imagine drowning and someone hands you another child. That is the joke that he makes. But what he's saying is after you have the second child, the third, fourth, and fifth, and so on, there's not a lot of difference occurring. And that's what people with bigger families would say. At the same time, while parents of large families have to make trade-offs, they learn to relax about the sorts of things that many parents of just two children take too seriously. Many requirements of modern parenting aren't requirements at all. One poll done for the Today Show in 2013 found that while mothers of three children experience more stress than mothers of one or two, mothers of four or more experience less stress. Kristen Riley, a working mother of seven kids, put it even more succinctly. She said, once you eventually get past two or more kids, you have to accept that not everything is going to be perfect. In other words, parents of many children learn something we all could benefit from internalizing. Trade-offs are inherent to life. And whether we have 8 children or none at all, we will be better off if we know that joy doesn't come from a life that's picture perfect. And that's true. I mean, we have, like I said, we have 4 kids. When we had our first, it was we wanted a kid so bad. And we prayed for a child, and we just could we didn't seem to we just couldn't get pregnant, and we didn't know what was going on, and I always wanted a big family. My wife's an only child, and so she doesn't even know what it's like to have siblings, and we just couldn't get pregnant. And then my wife came to me. I was working at UT, and she came to the office, and she said, "I'm pregnant." And we lost our minds, and we cried, and everybody in the office cried, and we had our first child. And then we thought, well, it's going to take this long every single time to get pregnant. Quickly after Gavin was born, we were pregnant again. And my wife came down and said, "I'm pregnant." And we went to the doctor, and a couple weeks later, and then we found out that Aaron had had a miscarriage. And so we thought, well, a positive is we were able to get pregnant quickly. A negative is this going to be a trend? We lost the child, and that was, we had to mourn through that. We had to work through that as a married couple, and what's that look like? And, you know, a lot of folks don't talk about miscarriage as a true loss. And for us, we were planning to have another baby. This was another baby coming into the mix, and that baby was no longer there. And then about a few months later, we found out we were pregnant, and here comes Summer Paige, and she's born. And then 2 years later, we find out, or about a year and a half later, we find out we're pregnant again. And then here comes Evelyn. And then about a year and a half later, we find out we're pregnant again. And here comes Charlie. And so it just became this, hey, this is what happens. And life is not perfect by no means. I mean, just going to a restaurant. You know, I remember with my first, with Gavin, we would go to a restaurant and he would cry. And there would be moments. I remember vividly sitting at Red Lobster because we're fancy. And we're sitting at Red Lobster, and Gavin will not stop crying. And so I walked Gavin around, and I let Aaron eat her food by herself. And then when she was done eating, I brought Gavin back, and Aaron walked Gavin around, and I ate my dinner. And we thought, this is going to be our life. And then we kept having kids, and now we go to restaurants, and I don't care if you stare at us. They're going to be loud. They're going to take their shoes off. They might come over to your table. The other night we were at Chili's because, again, we're fancy. And Gavin asked the waiter if he could hug him. And Gavin's 8 now. And it's a little weird. But guess what? This is the Wood family. It's what you get. And so as the family has grown, we've just kind of know, look, this isn't going to be perfect. We were coming back from Gulf Shores one summer. And Evelyn decided to throw up all over herself and the car seat. And if you know anything about car seats, you get vomit in there. It's very difficult to clean out. You know, then we've had messy diapers. We've had all of that. And so the perfect, whatever perfect is long out the window. And what I would argue is really the messiness and the chaos of a large family. That is perfect. It's perfect for us. There's a great country song that says, I know that she may not be perfect, but she's perfect for me. Okay, so I know that a large family may not be perfect for you, but it's perfect for me. And so if you see that family walking around the grocery store or at the restaurant, they have a large family and the kids are loud, and you know, instead of sitting back and going, man, bless their hearts, maybe say a little prayer for them. Maybe walk over and say, hey, I appreciate what you're doing with these kids. And recognize to that family. And also, if you see me out with 4 children, don't look at me and say, oh, you babysitting tonight. I'm not babysitting. They're my kids, okay? I'm being a dad. That's what dads are to do. So let's get that stigma gone, too, that dads just babysit when they have the kids. It's not babysitting when it's my children. And it's a beautiful thing. And so I appreciate large families. And it's messy. Go look at my 12-passenger. It's messy. We'll be back. And that's close enough to perfect for me. Kisses me each morning and smiles a sleepy smile. She don't have to say it, I can see it in her eyes. Don't you worry about my woman or what you think she ought to be. She's close enough.
I know that all things are working for my good. Yeah, he's intentional, never failing. All things are working for my good. He's intentional.
He's intentional.
Hey, and he's never failing.
So I'm pretty confident that there is no show in the country, maybe, dare I say, the world, where you would hear bumper music from Alabama, She's Close Enough to Perfect for Me, at the beginning of a break, and then you hear worship music coming back out of the break. I am quite confident this is the only show where you're getting that type of production, and we're grateful to have it. And so anytime Alabama can be played, not the football team, not anything about the state, but that country group, one of the greatest groups ever. It's a win. And so that's a win for you, and you're welcome for that. And you can thank the station for providing that type of music, that type of quality. You're not getting that anywhere else. I promise you that's not happened anywhere in this country or around the world today on a radio show anywhere or a podcast. You're just not getting it. And I'm grateful that we can bring that to you today, wherever you may be listening to this. So as we continue the conversation, I think it's important that we look at a couple things that have occurred over the last few weeks. One of that being there was a 200 plus members of Congress sent in a brief to the Supreme Court regarding June Medical Services versus Gee. The case involves a Louisiana law requiring abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, a policy similar to a Texas one that the court struck down in 2016. The court might address the situation with a scalpel, or it might take the opportunity to reconsider its abortion jurisprudence more broadly. And so, again, to give context, some Congress people sent a brief to the Supreme Court saying, let's take a look at Roe v. Wade. Let's take a look at some of the decisions that have been made. And this is an article at National Review as well. It goes further. A lot of the brief consists of the boring legal argumentation you'd probably expect. It encourages the court to find that the plaintiffs lack standing or failing that to uphold the Louisiana law as distinguishable from the invalidated Texas one. But then it suggests the court give some thought to reworking or overruling the decisions most prominently Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey that treat abortion as a constitutional right to begin with. Why? The answer is little unexpected. The right to abortion just isn't workable, as evidenced by the court's failure to create a stable and logical system for determining which abortion restrictions are constitutional and which are not. And they go further. Unsurprisingly, the brief has divided legal commentators. Mark Joseph Stern of Slate calls the argument a, quote, trick and a lie that may well give conservative justices, in particular Brett Kavanaugh, the excuse they need to depart from judicial precedents that have actually worked just fine for nearly half a century. National Review's own writer wrote at Bloomberg Opinion, says the brief makes a strong argument that, quote, could eventually prove decisive, perhaps in a future case rather than in June Medical Services itself. And then the article of this particular piece says, I see this a bit differently. It is difficult to create workable standards in this area, but that doesn't really distinguish abortion from countless other areas in which the court operates. And I'm not sure how big of a role it will or should play in Roe's demise. If there really were a constitutional right to abortion, or if the core of Roe were worth upholding as a precedent for other reasons, such as maintaining the stability of the law, it would be worth continuing to develop and improve the rules rather than ending judicial enforcement of the abortion right itself. And then he goes further. The central guideline since 1992 has been that states can place an, quote, undue burden, can't place an undue burden on women seeking abortions, a vague standard that leaves plenty of room for refinement. We who want to see the end of Roe should thus not put too many eggs in the, quote, workability basket, and there are plenty of arguments worth emphasizing more. To be clear, there is a workability problem, at least regarding the court's approach to the abortion issue up until now. Here's the GOP brief describing the court's various ping-pong moves over the years. Now buckle up and see if you can understand this. The court struck down regulations in Akron and Thornburgh, later approved in Casey. The court identified two state interests for abortion regulations in Roe, but recognized more in Gonzales. It struck down limits on partial birth abortion in Stenberg versus Carhart, later approved in Gonzales. It rejected facial challenges in Gonzales, resurrected in Hellerstedt. The court has retreated from Roe in at least four cases: Harris, Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, Casey, and Gonzalez, recalibrating the standard of review and giving states more deference to enact health and safety regulations and partial prohibitions. Now, I know that was a jumble mess and hard to understand, but what it's showing is these are flip-flops. The court has ruled one way and then, a few years later, ruled another way, and then they use that rule to then rule in this case, and then that they use that case to rule in another case. These flip-flops, as well as the conflicting abortion decisions that routinely issue from the lower courts as they try to parse confusing Supreme Court precedents, show the difficulty of separating limits on a right that are allowed from limits that are not allowed, especially when different jurists have different ideological commitments regarding the right and when many states are willing to get creative to limit the right any way they can. But this problem is present to some degree with any right, whether guaranteed by the Constitution, a statute, or a judicial precedence, and we rarely see it as a reason to rethink whether courts should enforce such rights at all. There's no argument in the brief that abortion rights are any harder for courts to manage than, say, gun rights, another area where the court standards are still young and evolving, and judges disagree on whether the right should exist at all. And while the court has wavered on the ways in which states may restrict abortion on the margins, it has been rock solid on the core question, whether a woman has a right to abort her child in the early months of pregnancy, which is when the vast majority of abortions occur. So while it is indeed challenging to create workable rules for abortion regulations, I called it the fourth best reason to strike at the heart of Roe itself. And this author says, my top three have to do with whether the decision was correct to begin with, and if not, other concerns bearing on whether it's the kind of precedent that the court should respect anyway. First, there really is nothing in the Constitution stopping states from regulating abortion as they see fit. So this is not an issue for the federal courts to resolve permanently the way they tried to in Roe. This is important. States are not doing what they need to do. There is nothing in the Constitution that stops states from regulating abortion. And they should see fit to move forward with positive pro-life legislation if they are, in fact, seeking to do that. Second, this decision to override voters' policy preferences has been highly consequential and horrific to those of us who oppose abortion. As Roe has facilitated the deaths of millions of helpless babies in jurisdictions that would have strictly limited the practice if they'd been allowed to. Third, unlike many other unoriginalist precedents from decades past, Roe has failed to settle into place as widely accepted and politically unremarkable part of our legal landscape, and it generates vigorous protests nearly 50 years after it was decided. States and even judges on the lower courts are pushing the boundaries on abortion laws to this day. You might disagree with my ranking. Heck, I stole three of the four elements from the late Justice Scalia in his list. He said, how wrong was it? How well accepted has it been? And number three, most important to me, does it permit me to function as a lawyer or does it make me a legislator? In explaining the third part, Scalia specifically called out the undue burden standard for abortion laws. But however we order these various tests, Roe flunks all of them. Combined, they amount to an incredibly powerful case for overruling a bad precedent that has lasted too long, claimed too many lives, taken too much power from the states, and sown too much discord by denying abortion opponents a fair chance to make a difference through the legislative process. Above all, the court should end it, and soon, no matter which reason it finds most compelling. And that's the truth. I mean, there's a political agenda behind this. There was a political agenda behind this back in the 70s to get Roe v. Wade, to get abortion. The goal was, we want abortion. It went from, look, we just want it to be safe, legal, and rare. That's it. You know, and then they gave the straw man argument, the farce of women in back alleys using coat hangers for abortion. And there's no proof of that being a widespread thing. That might have happened once or twice. It was not happening all across this country, but that was the argument they used. They used that argument and they wanted to use fear tactics to pressure the court. And frankly, when this was coming up, a lot of folks on the that would have considered them pro-life, considered themselves pro-life, didn't see that this was going to be a big deal. And then when they finally realized, oh, we might need to get involved in this, it was too late. And the decision came down. Then you have 1992, you have Casey versus Planned Parenthood. One of the best opportunities to overturn Roe v. Wade, and instead we find the undue burden clause. And so now you have states that are trying to restrict, and it goes to the courts, and then the courts say one way or the other. And so we're at a place now in 2020, probably closer than we've ever been since 1973, to seeing a true and a real challenge come for Roe. And again, even if Roe is overturned, it just goes back to the states. And if I believe that states should already be moving in that direction. And some states are trying their best to do that. We even in the state of Tennessee have we've already got a law in the books that as soon as Roe is overturned, abortion is illegal in this state. Now, we have more work to do, but it's nice to have that. If Roe is overturned tomorrow, abortion is illegal in the state of Tennessee. And other conservative states, other pro-life states should do the same. And so you're going to see that. The legislative session started today in the state of Tennessee. You're going to see some pro-life bills come out. The governor is pushing some. There's other legislators that I know that are pushing some to strengthen the pro-life laws in this country and to restrict abortion and to see abortion clinics close. We want to see a day where that occurs. But we have to be... We have to be engaged in the process. And I believe that we are at a point where people are starting to realize, where jurists are starting to realize, maybe that ruling in 1973 was wrongheaded. And I pray that we have some originalists in the Supreme Court, some constitutionalists that would say, there's nothing in our Constitution that guarantees the right to end the life of another. And I pray that day would come sooner rather than later. We'll be back. So I wanted to give you an update on where I will be in the next couple weeks, where we've already been to talk life and hope. We started the month at Belmont Heights on January 6th. We were at Calvary Chapel over on John Sevier this past Sunday, and that was a great crowd and really enjoyed our time with them. We'll be at Seventh-day Christian Assembly this Saturday, January 18th. Union Baptist Church on January 19th, that Sunday morning service. Parkway Baptist, January 26th, that's the morning service as well. And then Island Creek Baptist on February 2nd. So really looking forward to that. It's going to be a great time of fellowship and always fun to visit these churches and talk to folks like you in person, and also to speak about life and the gospel. And that's where we're going to always end up, is point people back to the gospel. That's why we do the work that we do, and we're certainly grateful for that. And so that's all happening in the coming weeks. Next week, I will not be here on air because I'm flying out next Wednesday to Washington, D.C., where I will be joining, like I said, half a million people for the March for Life. It's going to be a ton of people there. It's always a great crowd, always a lot of fun. And so we'll be there to enjoy that. Next week, the march is on Friday. We got some other things going on in D.C. while we're there. And then, like I said, the march will be on Friday. We'll be heading back next Saturday. But should be a great time. And always, you know, it's interesting. I don't want to sound like one of those people who's like, oh, the mainstream media, they never cover. But to be honest, they don't cover it. And so 500,000 people are going to be walking around D.C. to say that abortion needs to be ended. And you might get 30 seconds on a news feed. And they won't cover it. And last year, the vice president spoke. President Trump's been the only president. He sent a video last year. And you know, I think there will be a time, and it may be this year, I think, where he'll actually show up and speak. The problem is, for the president to speak to that large of a crowd outside, the security things that they would have to go through would be just insane. And most people probably wouldn't even be able to get in because of that. So I don't know if he'll actually speak, but he's been the only president to provide a video. So last year he provided a video. I believe Vice President Pence has spoke the last 2 years. And so just a great opportunity to get with folks and hear. And it's really encouraging. You know, a lot of times as pro-lifers, we feel like we're on the defense all the time. We feel like we're not winning. We feel like, well, because we don't get the cable interviews, because we don't have the you know, the constant talk of abortion. Planned Parenthood's got a big marketing budget. All of those things. I think at times we feel like we're losing. The reality is there's a lot of people doing a lot of amazing work across this country to see life celebrated. The reality is there's been judges appointed across this country, not just the Supreme Court level, but across the country, federal judges, been tons of, I think over 150 at this point by the current administration that are constitutionalist, that probably would line up with us when it comes to life and abortion. And so there's a lot of things occurring that behind the scenes that makes it appear as if we're getting closer and closer to the day that abortion would be illegal in this country, at least go back to the states. At least we would see Roe overturned, and that's obviously what we want. That'd be a great first step, is to see Roe overturned, and then we start to see states make it illegal around this country. That would be an amazing thing, and we're starting to see that occur. That's why Susan B. Anthony was having an event last night in Tennessee. That's why they have a presence now in Tennessee, because they see the writing on the wall, and they see that Roe is closer and closer and closer to being a thing of the past, a thing that we simply read about in the history books. And what an amazing thing to be a part of, that one day I can look at my children, my grandchildren, and say, we were part of the generation in this country that never stopped and that finally got to see Roe v. Wade overturned. Man, what an amazing, amazing truth that would be. What an amazing message that would be for our children, our grandchildren, for them one day to look back hundreds of years from now and go, that was the generation that stood up and said, enough is enough. Babies in the womb have value, and we're going to protect them. We're going to stand for them. And we get to be a part of it, folks. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon.